Shoving off cautiously from the beaches with a wary eye to the north, this group had landed into the thickest concentration of Kessel's forces, but also into the area that was under the shadow of the tower, where the fall of Kryshal Tirith had been the most disheartening. The fishermen found more goblins interested in running away than one intent on a fight. In the center of the field, where the heaviest fighting was taking place, the men of Ten Towns and their allies also seemed to be faring well. The barbarians had nearly joined with the dwarves. Spurred by the might of Wulfgar's hammer and the unrivaled courage of Brunner, the two forces were tearing apart all that stood between them, and they would soon become even more formidable, for Cassius and Glenn Sather were close by and moving in at a steady pace.
"By the tell my eyes tell me, your army does not fare well," Drizzt retorted. "The foolish men of Ten Towns are not defeated yet."
Kessel raised the crystal shard high above him, its light flaring to an even greater level of power. Down on the battlefield, even at the great distance, the combatants understood at once the resurgence of the powerful presence they had known as Kryshal Tirith. Human, dwarf, and goblin alike, even those locked in mortal combat, paused for a second to look at the beacon on the mountain. The monsters, sensing the return of their god, cheered wildly and abandoned their heretofore defensive posture. Encouraged by the glorious reappearance of Kessel, they pressed the attack with savage fury.
"You see how my mere presence incites them," Kessel boasted proudly.
But Drizzt wasn't paying attention to the wizard or the battle below. He was standing in puddles of water now, from snow melting under the warmth of the shining relic. He was intent on a noise that his keen ears had caught among the clatter of the distant fighting. A rumble of protest from the frozen peaks of Kelvin's cairn.
"Behold the glory of Akkar Kessel!"
the wizard cried, his voice magnified to deafening proportions by the power of the relic he held.
"How easy it shall be for me to destroy the boats on the lake below!"
Drizzt realized that Kessel, in his arrogant disregard for the dangers growing around him, was making a flagrant mistake. All that he had to do was delay the wizard from taking any decisive action for the next few moments. Reflexively, he grabbed the dagger at the back of his belt and flung it at Kessel. Though he knew that Kessel was joined in some perverted symbiosis with Kren Shinabon, and that the small weapon had no chance of hitting its mark. The drow was hoping to distract and anger the wizard, to divert his fury away from the battlefield. The dagger sped through the air. Drizzt turned and ran. A thin beam shot out from Kren Shinabon and melted the weapon before it found its mark, but Kessel was outraged.
"You should bow down before me," he screamed at Drizzt. "Blasphemous dog, you have earned the distinction of being my first victim of the day."
He swung the shard away from the ledge to point it at the fleeing drow, but as he spun, he sank suddenly up to his knees in the melting snow. Then he too heard the angry rumbles of the mountain. Drizzt broke free of the relic's sphere of influence, and without hesitating to look back, he ran, putting as much distance between himself and the southern face of Kelvin's cairn as he could. Immersed up to his chest now, Kessel struggled to get free of the watery snow. He called upon the power of Kren Shinabon again, but his concentration wavered under the intense stress of impending doom. Akkar Kessel felt weak again for the first time in years. Not the tyrant of Icewind Dale, but the bumbling apprentice who had murdered his teacher. As if the crystal shard had rejected him. Then, the entire side of the mountain snowcap fell. The rumble shook the land for many miles around. Men and orcs, goblins, and even ogres were thrown to the ground. Kessel clutched the shard close to him when he began to fall, but Kren Shinabon burned his hands, pushed him away. Kessel had failed too many times. The relic would no longer accept him as its wielder. Kessel screamed when he felt the shard slipping through his fingers. His shriek, though, was drowned out by the thunder of the avalanche. The cold darkness of snow closed around him, falling, tumbling with him on the descent. Kessel desperately believed that if he still held the crystal shard, he could survive even this. Small comfort when he settled onto a lower peak of Kelvin's cairn. And half of the mountain's cap landed on top of him. The monster army had seen their god fall again. The thread that had incited their momentum quickly began to unravel. But in the time that Kessel had reappeared, some measure of coordinating activity had taken place.
Two frost giants, the only remaining true giants in the wizard's entire army, had taken command. They called the elite ogre guard to their side, and then called for the orc and goblin tribes to gather around them and follow their lead. Still, the dismay of the army was obvious. Tribal rivalries that had been buried under the iron-fisted domination of Akkar Kessel resurfaced in the form of blatant mistrust. Only fear of their enemies kept them fighting, and only fear of the giants held them in line beside the other tribes. "Well met, Brunner!" Wulfgar sang out, splattering another goblin head as the barbarian horde finally broke through to the dwarves. "And to yourself, boy!" the dwarf replied, burying his axe into the chest of his own opponent. "Time's almost past that ye got back! I thought that I'd have to kill your share of the scum, too!" Wulfgar's attention was elsewhere, though. He had discovered the two giants commanding the force. "Frost giants," he told Brunner, directing the dwarf's gaze to the ring of ogres. "They are all that hold the tribes together." "Better sport," Brunner laughed. "Lead on!" And so, with his principal attendants and Brunner beside him, the young king started smashing a path through the goblin ranks. The ogres crowded in front of their newfound commanders to block the barbarians' path. Wulfgar was close enough by then. Aegis Fang whistled past the ogre ranks and took one of the giants in the head, dropping it lifeless to the ground. The other, gawking in disbelief that a human had been able to deliver such a deadly blow against one of its kind from such a distance, hesitated for only a brief moment before it fled the battle. Undaunted, the vicious ogres charged in on Wulfgar's group, pushing them back. But Wulfgar was satisfied, and he willingly gave ground before the press, anxious to rejoin the bulk of the human and dwarven army. Brunner wasn't so willing, though. This was the type of chaotic fighting that he most enjoyed. He disappeared under the long legs of the leading line of ogres and moved, unseen in the dust and confusion, among their ranks. From the corner of his eye, Wulfgar saw the dwarf's odd departure. "Where are you off to?" he shouted after him. But battle-hungry Brunner couldn't hear the call and wouldn't have heeded it anyway. Wulfgar couldn't view the flight of the wild dwarf, but he could approximate Brunner's position, or at least where the dwarf had just been, as ogre after ogre doubled over in surprised agony, clutching a knee, hamstring, or groin. Above all of the commotion, those orcs and goblins who weren't engaged in direct combat kept a watchful eye on Kelvin's cairn, awaiting the second resurgence, but settled now on the lower slopes of the mountain. There was only snow. Lusting for revenge, the fighting men of Kaer Konig and Kaer Dinnaval brought their ships in under full sail, sliding them up recklessly onto the sands of the shallows to avoid the delays of mooring in deeper waters. They leaped from the boats and splashed ashore, rushing into the battle with a fearless frenzy that drove their opponents away. Once they had established themselves on the land, Jensen Brent brought them together in a tight formation and turned them south. The spokesman heard the fighting far off in that direction and knew that the men of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole were cutting a swath north to join up with his men. His plan was to meet them on the east way and then drive westward toward Bryn Shander with his reinforced numbers. Many of the goblins on this side of the city had long since fled, and many more had gone northwest to the ruins of Kryshal Tirith and the main fighting. The army of Lac Dinashir made good speed toward their goal. They reached the road with few losses and dug in to wait for the southerners. Kemp watched anxiously for the signal from the lone ship sailing on the waters of Mare Dualden. The spokesman from Targos, appointed commander of the forces of the four cities of the lake, had moved cautiously thus far for fear of a heavy assault from the north. He held his men in check, allowing them to fight only the monsters that came to them, though this conservative stance, with the sounds of raging battle howling across the field, was tearing at his adventurous heart. As the minutes had dragged along with no sign of goblin reinforcements, the spokesman had sent a small schooner to run up the coastline and find out what was delaying the occupying force in Tourmaline. Then he spied the white sails gliding into view. Riding high upon the small ship's bow was the signal flag that Kemp had most desired but least expected, the red banner of the catch, though in this instance it signaled that Tourmaline was clear and the goblins were fleeing northward. Kemp ran to the highest spot he could find, his face flushed with a vengeful desire.
"Break the line, boys," he shouted to his men. "Cut me a swath to the city on the hill. Let Cassius come back and find us sitting on the doorstep of his town."
They shouted wildly with every step, men who had lost homes and kin and seen their cities burned out from under them. Many of them had nothing left to lose. All that they could hope to gain was a small taste of bitter satisfaction. The battle raged for the remainder of the morning, man and monster alike lifting swords and spears that seemed to have doubled their weight. Yet exhaustion, though it slowed their reflexes, did nothing to temper the anger that burned in the blood of every combatant. The battle lines grew indistinguishable as the fighting wore on, with troops getting hopelessly separated from their commanders. In many places, goblins and orcs fought against each other, unable, even with a common foe so readily available, to sublimate their long-standing hatred for the rival tribes. A thick cloud of dust enveloped the heaviest concentrations of fighting. The dizzying clamor of steel grating on steel, swords banging against shields, and the expanding screams of death, agony, and victory degenerated the structured clash into an all-out brawl. The sole exception was the group of battle-seasoned dwarves. Their ranks did not waver or disintegrate in the least, though Brunner had not yet returned to them after his strange exit. The dwarves provided a solid platform for the barbarians to strike from, and for Wulfgar and his small group to mark for their return. The young king was back among the ranks of his men, just as Cassius and his force linked up. The spokesman and Wulfgar exchanged intense stares, neither certain of where he stood with the other. Both were wise enough to trust fully in their alliance for the present, though. Both understood that intelligent foes put aside their differences in the face of a greater enemy. Supporting each other would be the only advantage that the newly banded allies enjoyed. Together, they outnumbered and could overwhelm any individual orc or goblin tribe they faced, and since the goblin tribes would not work in unison, each group had no external support on its flanks. Wulfgar and Cassius, following and supporting each other's movements, sent out defensive spurs of warriors to hold off perimeter groups, while the main force of the combined army blasted through one tribe at a time. Though his troops had cut down better than 10 goblins for every man they had lost, Cassius was truly concerned. Thousands of the monsters had not even come in contact with the humans or raised a weapon yet, and his men were nearly dropping with fatigue. He had to get them back to the city. He let the dwarves lead the way. Wulfgar, also apprehensive about his warriors' ability to maintain their pace, and knowing that there was no other escape route, instructed his men to follow Cassius and the dwarves. This was a gamble, for the barbarian king wasn't even certain that the people of Bryn Shander would let his warriors into the city. Kemp's force had made impressive initial headway in their charge to the slopes of the principal city, but as they neared their goal, they ran up against heavier and more desperate concentrations of humanoids. Barely 100 yards from the hill, they were bogged down and fighting on all sides. The armies rolling in from the east had done better. Their rush down the east way had met with little resistance, and they were the first to reach the hill. They had sailed madly across the breadth of the lakes and ran and fought all the way across the plain. Yet Jensen Brent, the lone surviving spokesman of the original four, for Shermont and the two from the southern cities had fallen on the east way, would not let them rest. He clearly heard the heated battle and knew that the brave men in the northern fields, facing the mass of Kessel's army, needed any support they could get. Yet when the spokesman led his troops around the final bend to the city's north gate, they froze in their tracks and looked upon the spectacle of the most brutal battle they had ever seen or ever heard of in exaggerated tales. Combatants battled atop the hacked bodies of the fallen. Fighters, who had somehow lost their weapons, bit and scratched at their opponents. Brent surmised at once that Cassius and his large force would be able to make it back to the city on their own. The armies of Mayor Duwalden, though, were in a tight spot. "To the west!" he cried to his men as he charged toward the trapped force. A new surge of adrenaline sent the weary army in full flight to the rescue of their comrades. On orders from Brent, they came down off of the slopes in a long side-by-side line, but when they reached the battlefield, only the middle group continued forward. The groups at the ends of the formation collapsed into the middle, and the whole force had soon formed a wedge, its tip breaking all the way through the monsters to reach Kemp's embattled armies. Kemp's men eagerly accepted the lifeline, and the united force was soon able to retreat to the northern face of the hill. The last stragglers stumbled in at the same time as the army of Cassius, Wulfgar's barbarians, and the dwarves broke free of the closest ranks of goblins and climbed the open ground of the hill. Now, with the humans and dwarves joined as one force, the goblins moved in tentatively. Their losses had been staggering. No giants or ogres remained, and several entire tribes of goblins and orcs lay dead. Kryshel Tirith was a pile of blackened rubble, and Akkar Kessel was buried in a frozen grave. The men on Bryn Shander's Hill were battered and wobbly with exhaustion, yet the grim set of their jaws told the remaining monsters unequivocally that they would fight on to their last breath. They had backed into the final corner. There would be no further retreat. Doubts crept into the mind of every goblin and orc that remained to carry on the war. Though their numbers were still probably sufficient to complete the task, many more of them would yet fall before the fierce men of Ten Towns, and their deadly allies would be put down. Even then, which of the surviving tribes would claim victory? Without the guidance of the wizard, the survivors of the battle would certainly be hard-pressed to fairly divide the spoils without further fighting. The Battle of Icewind Dale had not followed the course that Akkar Kessel had promised.
31. Victory? The men of Ten Towns, along with their dwarven and barbarian allies, had fought their way from all sides of the wide field and now stood unified before the northern gate of Bryn Shander. And while their army had achieved a singular fighting stance, with all of the once separate groups banded together toward the common goal of survival, Kessel's army had gone down the opposite road. When the goblins had first charged into Icewind Pass, their common purpose was victory for the glory of Akkar Kessel. But Kessel was gone and Kryshel Tirith destroyed, and the cord that held together the long-standing, bitter enemies, the rival orc and goblin tribes, had begun to unravel. The humans and dwarves looked upon the mass of invaders with returning hope, for on all the outer fringes of the vast force, dark shapes continued to break away and flee from the battlefield and back to the tundra. Still, the defenders of Ten Towns were surrounded on three sides with their backs to Bryn Shander's walls. At this point, the monsters made no move to press the attack, but thousands of goblins held their positions all around the northern fields of the city. Earlier in the battle, when the initial attacks had caught the invaders by surprise, the leaders of the engaged defending forces would have considered such a lull in the fighting disastrous, stealing their momentum and allowing their stunned enemies to regroup into more favorable formations. Now, though, the break came as a twofold blessing. It gave the soldiers a desperately needed rest and let the goblins and orcs fully absorb the beating they had taken. The field on this side of the city was littered with corpses, many more goblin than human, and the crumbled pile that was Kryshel Tirith only heightened the monsters' perceptions of their staggering losses. No giants or ogres remained to bolster their thinning lines, and each passing second saw more of their allies desert the cause. Cassius had time to call all the surviving spokesmen to his side for a brief council. A short distance away, Wulfgar and Revyak were meeting with Fender Maleth, the appointed leader of the dwarven forces, in light of Brunner's disturbing absence.
"Glad we are of your return, mighty Wulfgar," Fender said. "Brunner knew ye'd be back."
Wulfgar looked out over the field, searching for some sign that Brunner was still out there swinging.
"Have you any news of Brunner at all?"
"Ye yourself were the last to see him,"
Fender replied grimly. And then they were silent, scanning the field.
"Let me hear again the ring of your axe," Wulfgar whispered. But Brunner could not hear him.
"Jensen," Cassius asked the spokesman from Caer Dinnaval, "where are your womenfolk and children? Are they safe?"
"Safe in Easthaven," Jensen Brent replied, "joined by now by the people of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole. They are well provisioned and watched. If Kessel's wretches make for the town, the people shall know of the danger with ample time left for them to put back out onto Lac Dinashir."
"But how long could they survive on the water?" Cassius asked. Jensen Brent shrugged noncommittally.
"Until the winter falls, I should guess. They shall always have a place to land, though, for the remaining goblins and orcs could not possibly encompass even half of the lake's shoreline."
Cassius seemed satisfied. He turned to Kemp.
"Lonelywood,"
Kemp answered to his unspoken question.
"And I'll wager that they're better off than we are. They've enough boats in dock there to found a city in the middle of Mare Dualden."
"That is good," Cassius told them. "It leaves yet another option open to us. We could perhaps hold our ground here for a while, then retreat back within the walls of the city. The goblins and orcs, even with their greater numbers, couldn't hope to conquer us there. The idea seemed to appeal to Jensen Brent, but Kemp scowled.
So our folk may be safe enough, he said, but what of the barbarians?
Their women are sturdy and capable of surviving without them, Cassius replied.
I care not the least for their foul-smelling women, Kemp blustered, purposely raising his voice so that Wulfgar and Revyak, holding their own counsel not far away, could hear him. I speak of these wild dogs themselves. Surely you're not going to open your door wide in invitation to them.
Proud Wulfgar started toward the spokesman. Cassius turned angrily on Kemp.
Stubborn ass, he whispered harshly. Our only hope lies in unity.
Our only hope lies in attacking, Kemp retorted. We have them terrified, and you ask us to run and hide.
The huge barbarian king stepped up before the two spokesmen, towering above them.
Greetings, Cassius of Bryn Shander, he said politely. I am Wulfgar, son of Beornagar, and leader of the tribes who have come to join in your noble cause.
What could your kind possibly know of nobility? Kemp interrupted.
Wulfgar ignored him. I have overheard much of your discussion, he continued, unshaken. It is my judgment that your ill-mannered and ungrateful adviser, he paused for control, has proposed the only solution.
Cassius, still expecting Wulfgar to be enraged at Kemp's insults, was at first confused.
Attack, Wulfgar explained. The goblins are uncertain now of what gains they can hope to make. They wonder why they ever followed the evil wizard to this place of doom. If they are allowed to find their battle lust again, they will prove a more formidable foe.
I thank you for your words, barbarian king, Cassius replied. Yet it is my guess that this rabble will not be able to support a siege. They will leave the fields before a 10-day has passed.
Perhaps, said Wulfgar. Yet even then your people shall pay dearly. The goblins leaving of their own choice will not return to their caves empty-handed. There are still several unprotected cities that they could strike at on their way out of Icewind Dale. And worse yet, they shall not leave with fear in their eyes. Your retreat shall save the lives of some of your men, Cassius, but it will not prevent the future return of your enemies.
Then you agree that we should attack? Cassius asked.
Our enemies have come to fear us. They look about and see the ruin we have brought down upon them. Fear is a powerful tool, especially against cowardly goblins. Let us complete the rout, as your people did to mine 5 years ago.
Cassius recognized the pain in Wulfgar's eyes as he recalled the incident.
And send these foul beasts scurrying back to their mountain homes. Many years shall pass before they venture out to strike at your towns again.
Cassius looked upon the young barbarian with profound respect, and also deep curiosity. He could hardly believe that these proud tundra warriors, who vividly remembered the slaughter they had suffered at the hands of 10 townsmen, had come to the aid of the fishing communities.
My people did indeed rout yours, noble king, brutally. Why then have you come?
This is a matter we shall discuss after we have completed our task, Wulfgar answered. Now let us sing. Let us strike terror into the hearts of our enemies and break them.
He turned to Revyak and some of his other leaders.
Sing, proud warriors, he commanded. Let the song of Tempest foretell the death of the goblins.
A rousing cheer went up throughout the barbarian ranks, and they lifted their voices proudly to their god of war. Cassius noted the immediate effect the song had on the closest monsters. They backed away a step and clutched their weapons tightly. A smile crossed the spokesman's face. He still couldn't understand the barbarian's presence, but explanations would have to wait.
Join our barbarian allies, he shouted to his soldiers. Today is a day of victory.
The dwarves had taken up the grim war chant of their ancient homeland. The fishermen of 10 towns followed the words of the Song of Tempest, tentatively at first, until the foreign inflections and phrases easily rolled from their lips. And then they joined in fully, proclaiming the glory of their individual towns, as the barbarians did of their tribes. The tempo increased, the volume moved toward a powerful crescendo. The goblins trembled at the growing frenzy of their deadly enemies. The stream of deserters flowing away from the edges of the main gathering grew thicker and thicker. And then, As one killing wave, the human and dwarven allies charged down the hill.
Drizzt had been able to scramble far enough away from the southern face to escape the fury of the avalanche, but he still found himself in a dangerous predicament. Kelvin's cairn wasn't a high mountain, but the top third was perpetually covered with deep snow and brutally exposed to the icy wind that gave this land its name. Even worse for the drow, his feet had gotten wet in the melt caused by Crin Shinabon, and now, as the moisture hardened around his skin to ice, movement through the snow was painful. He resolved to plod on, making for the western face, which offered the best protection against the wind. His motions were violent and exaggerated, expending all of the energy that he could to keep the circulation flowing through his veins. When he reached the lip of the mountain's peak and started down, he had to move more tentatively, fearing that any sudden jolts would deliver him into the same grim fate that had befallen Akar Kessel. His legs were completely numb now, but he kept them moving, almost having to force his automatic reflexes. But then he slipped. Wolfgar's fierce warriors were the first to crash into the goblin line, hacking and pushing back the first rank of monsters. Neither goblin nor orc dared stand before the mighty king, but in the crowded confusion of the fighting, few could find their way out of his path. One after another, they fell to the ground. Fear had all but paralyzed the goblins, and their slight hesitation had spelled doom for the first groups to encounter the savage barbarians. Yet the downfall of the army ultimately came from further back in the ranks. The tribes who had not even been involved in the fighting began to ponder the wisdom of continuing this campaign, for they recognized that they had gained enough of an advantage over their homeland rivals, weakened by heavy losses, to expand their territories back in the spine of the world. Shortly after the second outburst of fighting had begun, the dust cloud of stamping feet once again rose above Icewind Pass as dozens of orc and goblin tribes headed home. And the effect of the mass desertions on those goblins who could not easily flee was devastating. Even the most dim-witted goblin understood its people's chance for victory against the stubborn defenders of Ten Towns lay in the overwhelming weight of their numbers. Aegis Fang thudded repeatedly as Wolfgar, charging in alone, swept a path of devastation before him. Even the men of Ten Towns shied away from him, unnerved by his savage strength. But his own people looked upon him with awe and tried their best to follow his glorious lead. Wolfgar waded in on a group of orcs. Aegis Fang slammed home on one, killing it and knocking those behind it to the ground. Wolfgar's backswing with a hammer produced the same results on his other flank. In one burst, more than half of the group of orcs were killed or lying stunned. Those remaining had no desire to move in on the mighty human. Len Sather of Easthaven also waded in on a group of goblins, hoping to incite his people with the same fury as his barbarian counterpart. But Glensather wasn't an imposing giant like Wolfgar, and he didn't wield a weapon as mighty as Aegis Fang. His sword cut down the first goblin he encountered, then spun back deftly and felled a second. The spokesman had done well, but one element was missing from his attack, the critical factor that elevated Wolfgar above other men. Glensather had killed two goblins, but he had not caused the chaos in their ranks that he needed to continue. Instead of fleeing, as they did before Wolfgar, the remaining goblins pressed in behind him. Glensather had just come up beside the barbarian king when the cruel tip of a spear dived into his back and tore through, driving out the front of his chest. Witnessing the gruesome spectacle, Wolfgar brought Aegis Fang over the spokesman, driving the head of the spear-wielding goblin down into its chest. Glensather heard the hammer connect behind him and even managed to smile his thanks before he fell dead to the grass. The dwarves worked differently than their allies. Once again formed into their tight, supportive formation, they mowed down rows of goblins simultaneously, and the fishermen, fighting for the lives of their women and children, fought and died without fear. In less than an hour, every group of goblins had been smashed, and half an hour after that, the last of the monsters fell dead to the blood-stained field. Drizzt rode the white wave of falling snow down the side of the mountain. He tumbled helplessly, trying to brace himself whenever he saw the jutting tip of a boulder in his path. As he neared the base of the snow cap, he was thrown clear of the slide and sent bouncing through the gray rocks and boulders, as though the mountain's proud, unconquerable peaks had spit him out like an uninvited guest. His agility and a strong dose of pure luck saved him.
When he at last was able to stop his momentum and find a perch, he discovered that his numerous injuries were superficial, a scrape on his knee, a bloodied nose, and a sprained wrist being the worst of them. In retrospect, Drizzt had to consider the small avalanche a blessing, for he had made swift progress down the mountain, and he wasn't even certain that he could have otherwise escaped Kessel's frosty fate without it. The battle in the south had begun again by this time. Hearing the sounds of the fighting, Drizzt watched curiously as thousands of goblins passed by on the other side of the Dwarven Valley, running up Icewind Pass on the first legs of their long journey home. The drow couldn't be sure of what was happening, though he was familiar with the cowardly reputation of goblins. He didn't give it too much thought, though, for the battle was no longer his first concern. His vision followed a narrow path to the mound of broken black stonework that had been Kryshal Tirith. He finished his descent from Kelvin's cairn and headed down Brayman's Run toward the rubble. He had to find out if Regis or Guinevar had escaped. Victory. It seemed a small comfort to Cassius, Kemp, and Jensen Brent as they looked around at the carnage on the scarred field. They were the only three spokesmen to have survived the struggle. Seven others had been cut down. "We have won," Cassius declared grimly. He watched helplessly as more soldiers fell dead, men who had suffered mortal wounds earlier in the battle, but had refused to fall down and die until they had seen it through. More than half of all the men of Ten Towns lay dead, and many more would later die, for nearly half of those still alive had been grievously wounded. Four towns had been burned to the ground, and another one looted and torn apart by occupying goblins. They had paid a terrible price for their victory. The barbarians, too, had been decimated. Mostly young and inexperienced, they had fought with the tenacity of their breeding and died accepting their fate as a glorious ending to their life's tale. Only the dwarves, disciplined by many battles, had come through relatively unscathed. Several had been slain, a few others wounded, but most were all too ready to take up the fight again if only they could have found more goblins to bash. Their one great lament, though, was that Brunner was missing. "Go to your people," Cassius told his fellow spokesman. "Then return this evening to council. Kemp shall speak for all the people of the four towns of Mare Dualden, Jensen Brent for the people of the other lakes." "We have much to decide and little time to do it," Jensen Brent said. "Winter is fast approaching."
"We shall survive,"
Kemp declared with his characteristic defiance. But then he was aware of the sullen looks his peers had cast upon him, and he conceded a bit to their realism.
"Oh, it will be a bitter struggle."
"So it shall be for my people," said another voice.
The three spokesmen turned to see the giant Wulfgar striding out from the dusty, surrealistic scene of carnage. The barbarian was caked in dirt and spattered with the blood of his enemies, but he looked every bit the noble king.
"I request an invitation to your council, Cassius. There is much that our people can offer to each other in this harsh time,"
Kemp growled.
"If we need beasts of burden, we'll buy oxen."
Cassius shot Kemp a dangerous look and addressed his unexpected ally. "You may indeed join the council, Wulfgar, son of Beornigar. For your aid this day, my people owe yours much. Again, I ask you, why did you come?" For the second time that day, Wulfgar ignored Kemp's insults.
"To repay a debt," he replied to Cassius. "And perhaps to better the lives of both our peoples."
"By killing goblins?" Jensen Brent asked, suspecting that the barbarian had more in mind.
"A beginning," Wulfgar answered. "Yet there is much more that we may accomplish. My people know the tundra better than even the Yetis. We understand its ways and know how to survive. Your people would benefit from our friendship, especially in the hard times that lay ahead for you."
"Bah!"
Kemp snorted, but Cassius silenced him. The spokesman from Bryn Shander was intrigued by the possibilities. "And what would your people gain from such a union?"
"A connection," Wulfgar answered. "A link to a world of luxuries that we have never known.
The tribes hold a dragon's treasure in their hands, but golden jewels do not provide warmth on a winter night, nor food when game is scarce. Your people have much rebuilding to do. My people have the wealth to assist in that task. In return, 10 towns will deliver my people into a better life."
Cassius and Jensen Brent nodded approvingly as Wulfgar laid out his plan.
"Finally, and perhaps most important," the barbarian concluded, "is the fact that we need each other, for the present at least. Both of our peoples have been weakened and are vulnerable to the dangers of this land. Together, our remaining strength would see us through the winter."
"You intrigue and surprise me," Cassius said. "Attend the council, then, with my personal welcome, and let us put in motion a plan that will benefit all who have survived the struggle against Akar Kessel."
As Cassius turned, Wulfgar grabbed Kemp's shirt with one of his huge hands and easily hoisted the spokesman from Targos off the ground. Kemp swatted at the muscled forearm, but realized that he had no chance of breaking the barbarian's iron grip. Wulfgar glared at him dangerously.
"For now," he said, "I am responsible for all my people. Thus have I disregarded your insults. But when the day comes that I am no longer king, you would do well to cross my path no more."
With a flick of his wrist, he tossed the spokesman to the ground. Kemp, too intimidated for the present to be angry or embarrassed, sat where he landed and did not respond. Cassius and Brent nudged each other and shared a low chuckle. It lasted only until they saw the girl approaching, her arm in a bloody sling and her face and auburn hair caked with layers of dust. Wulfgar saw her too, and the sight of her wounds pained him more than his own ever could.
"Catti Bree," he cried, rushing to her.
She calmed him with an outstretched palm.
"I am not badly injured," she assured Wulfgar stoically, though it was obvious to the barbarian that she had been sorely injured. "Though I dare not think of what would have befallen me if Brunner had not arrived."
"You have seen Brunner?"
"In the tunnels," Catti Bree explained. "Some orcs found their way in. Perhaps I should have collapsed the tunnel. Yet there weren't many, and I could hear that the dwarves were doing well on the field above. Brunner came down then, but there were more orcs at his back. A support beam collapsed. I think Brunner cut it out, and there was too much dust and confusion."
"And Brunner?" Wulfgar asked anxiously.
Catti Bree looked back across the field. "Out there. He has asked for you."
By the time Drizzt reached the rubble that had been Kryshal Tirith, the battle was over. The sights and sounds of the horrible aftermath pressed in all about him, but his goal remained unchanged. He started up the side of the broken stones. In truth, the drow thought himself a fool for following such a hopeless cause. Even if Regis and Guinevar hadn't gotten out of the tower, how could he possibly hope to find them? He pressed on stubbornly, refusing to give in to the inescapable logic that scolded him. This was where he differed from his people. This was what had driven him, finally, from the unbroken darkness of their vast cities. Drizzt Do'Urden allowed himself to feel compassion. He moved up the side of the rubble and began digging around the debris with his bare hands. Larger blocks prevented him from going very deep into the pile, yet he did not yield, even squeezing into precariously tight and unstable crevices. He used his burned left hand little, and soon his right was bleeding from scraping. But he continued on, moving first around the pile, then scaling higher. He was rewarded for his persistence, for his emotions. When he reached the top of the ruins, he felt a familiar aura of magical power. It guided him to a small crevice between two stones. He reached in tentatively, hoping to find the object intact, and pulled out the small feline figurine. His fingers trembled as he examined it for damage, but he found none. The magic within the object had resisted the weight of the rubble. The drow's feelings at the find were mixed, however. Though he was relieved that Guinevar had apparently survived, the presence of the figurine told him that Regis had probably not escaped to the field. His heart sank, and sank even farther when a sparkle within the same crevice caught his eye. He reached in and pulled out the golden chain with the ruby pendant, and his fears were confirmed. "A fitting tomb for you, brave little friend," he
he said somberly, and he decided at that moment to name the pile Regis's Cairn. He could not understand, though, what had happened to separate the halfling from his necklace, for there was no blood or anything else on the chain to indicate that Regis had been wearing it when he died. "Guinevere," he called. "Come to me, my shadow." He felt the familiar sensations in the figurine as he placed it on the ground before him. Then the black mist appeared and formed into the great cat, unharmed and somewhat restored by the few hours it had spent back on its own plane. Drizzt moved quickly toward his feline companion, but then he stopped as a second mist appeared a short distance away and began to solidify. Regis. The halfling sat with eyes closed and his mouth opened wide, as though he was about to take an enjoyable and enormous bite out of some unseen delicacy. One of his hands was clenched to the side of his eager jowls, and the other open before him. As his mouth snapped shut on empty air, his eyes snapped open in surprise.
"Drizzt!" he groaned. "Really, you should ask before you steal me away. This perfectly marvelous cat had caught me the juiciest meal."
Drizzt shook his head and smiled with a mixture of relief and disbelief.
"Oh, splendid!" Regis cried. "You have found my gemstone. I thought that I had lost it. For some reason it didn't make the journey with the cat and me."
Drizzt handed the ruby back to him. The cat could take someone along on its travels through the plains. Drizzt resolved to explore this facet of Guinevere's power later. He stroked the cat's neck, then released it back to its own world where it could further recuperate.
"Come, Regis," he said grimly. "Let us see where we might be of assistance."
Regis shrugged resignedly and stood to follow the drow. When they crested the top of the ruins and saw the carnage spread out below them, the halfling realized the enormity of the destruction. His legs nearly faltered under him, but he managed, with some help from his agile friend, to make the descent.
"We won?"
he asked Drizzt when they neared the level of the field, unsure if the people of Ten Towns had labeled what he saw before him victory or defeat.
"We survived,"
Drizzt corrected. A shout went up suddenly as a group of fishermen, seeing the two companions, rushed toward them, yelling with abandon.
"Wizard Slayer and Tower Breaker," they cried.
Drizzt, ever humble, lowered his eyes.
"Hail Regis," the men continued, "the hero of Ten Towns."
Drizzt turned a surprised but amused eye on his friend. Regis merely shrugged helplessly, acting as much the victim of the error as Drizzt. The men caught hold of the halfling and hoisted him to their shoulders.
"We shall carry you in glory to the council taking place within the city," one proclaimed. "You, above all others, should have a say in the decisions that will be made."
Almost as an afterthought, the man said to Drizzt,
"You can come too, drow."
Drizzt declined.
"All hail Regis," he said. A smile splayed across his face. "Ah, little friend. Ever you have the fortune to find gold in the mud where others wallow."
He clapped the halfling on the back and stood aside as the procession began. Regis looked back over his shoulder and rolled his eyes, as though he were merely going along for the ride. But Drizzt knew better. The drow's amusement was short-lived. Before he had even moved away from the spot, two dwarves hailed him.
"It is good that we have found ye, friend elf," said one.
The drow knew at once that they bore grim news.
"Brunner?"
he asked. The dwarves nodded.
"He lies near death. Even now he might be gone. He has asked for ye."
Without another word, the dwarves led Drizzt across the field to a small tent they had set up near their tunnel exits and escorted him inside. Inside, candles flickered softly. Beyond the single cot, against the wall opposite the entrance, stood Wulfgar and Ketty Bree, their heads bent reverently. Brunner lay on the cot, his head and chest wrapped in blood-stained bandages. His breathing was raspy and shallow, as though each breath would be his last. Drizzt moved solemnly to his side, stoically determined to hold back the uncharacteristic tears that welled in his lavender eyes. Brunner would prefer strength.
"Is it the elf?"
Brunner gasped when he saw the dark form over him.
"I have come," dearest of friends, Drizzt replied. To see me on me way?
Drizzt couldn't honestly answer so blunt a question. On your way? He forced a laugh from his constricting throat.
You have suffered worse. I'll hear no talk of dying. Who then would find Mithril Hall?
Ah, my home.
Brunner settled back at the name and seemed to relax, almost as if he felt that his dreams would carry him through the dark journey before him.
You're to come with me, then.
Of course, Drizzt agreed.
He looked to Wulfgar and Catti Bree for support, but lost in their own grief, they kept their eyes averted.
But not now.
No, no, Brunner explained.
Wouldn't do with the winter so close.
He coughed.
In the spring. Yes, in the spring.
His voice trailed away, and his eyes closed.
Yes, my friend, Drizzt agreed. In the spring. I shall see you to your home in the spring.
Brunner's eyes cracked open again, their deathly glaze washed away by a hint of the old sparkle. A contented smile widened across the dwarf's face, and Drizzt was happy that he had been able to comfort his dying friend. The drow looked back to Wulfgar and Catti Bree, and they too were smiling. At each other, Drizzt noted curiously. Suddenly, to Drizzt's surprise and horror, Brunner sat up and tore away the bandages.
There! He roared, to the amusement of the others in the tent. Ye've said it, and I have witnesses to the fact.
Drizzt, after nearly falling over with the initial shock, scowled at Wulfgar. The barbarian and Catti Bree fought hard to subdue their laughter.
Wulfgar shrugged, and a chuckle escaped. Brunner said that he would cut me down to the height of a dwarf if I said a word.
And so he would have, Catti Bree added.
The two of them made a hasty exit.
A council in Bryn Shander, Wulfgar explained hastily.
Outside the tent, their laughter erupted unheeded.
Damn you, Brunner Battlehammer, the drow scowled.
Then, unable to stop himself, he threw his arms around the barrel-shaped dwarf and hugged him.
Get it over with,
Brunner groaned, accepting the embrace.
But be quick! We've a lot of work to do through the winter. Spring'll be here sooner than ye think, and on the first warm day we leave for Mithril Hall.
Wherever that might be, Drizzt laughed, too relieved to be angered by the trick.
We'll make it, drow, Brunner said. We always do.
Epilogue. The people of Ten Towns and their barbarian allies found the winter following the battle a difficult one. But by pooling their talents and resources, they managed to survive. Many councils were held throughout those long months with Cassius, Jensen Brent, and Kemp representing the people of Ten Towns, and Wulfgar and Revyak speaking for the barbarian tribes. The first order of business was to officially recognize and condone the alliance of the two peoples, though many on both sides were strongly opposed. Those cities left untouched by Akar Kessel's army were packed full of refugees during the brutal winter. Reconstruction began with the first signs of spring. When the region was well on its way to recovery, and after the barbarian expedition following Wulfgar's directions returned with the dragon's treasure, councils were held to divide the towns among the surviving people. Relations between the two peoples almost broke down several times and were held together only by the commanding presence of Wulfgar and the continued calm of Cassius. When all was finally settled, the barbarians were given the cities of Bremen and Caer Conig to rebuild. The homeless of Caer Conig were moved into the reconstructed city of Caer Dinneval, and the refugees of Bremen who did not wish to live among the tribesmen were offered homes in the newly built city of Targos. It was a difficult situation, where traditional enemies were forced to put aside their differences and live in close quarters. Though victorious in the battle, the people of the towns could not call themselves winners. Everyone had suffered tragic losses. No one had come out better for the fight. Except Regis. The opportunistic halfling was awarded the title of First Citizen and the finest house in all of Ten Towns for his part in the battle.
Cassius readily surrendered his palace to the Tower Breaker. Regis accepted the spokesman's offer and all of the other numerous gifts that rolled in from every city, for though he hadn't truly earned the accolades awarded him, he justified his good fortune by considering himself a partner of the unassuming drow. And since Drizdo Erden wasn't about to come to Bryn Shander and collect the rewards, Regis figured that it was his duty to do so. This was the pampered lifestyle that the halfling had always desired. He truly enjoyed the excessive wealth and luxuries, though he would later learn that there was indeed a hefty price to be paid for fame. Drizden Brunner had spent the winter in preparation for their search for Mithril Hall. The drow intended to honor his word, though he had been tricked, because life hadn't changed much for him after the battle. Although he was in truth the hero of the fight, he still found himself barely tolerated among the people of Ten Towns, and the barbarians, other than Wulfgar and Revyak, openly avoided him, mumbling warding prayers to their gods whenever they inadvertently crossed his path. But the drow accepted the shunning with his characteristic stoicism.
"The whispers in town say that you have given your voice at council to Revyak," Catty Bree said to Wulfgar on one of her many visits to Bryn Shander.
Wulfgar nodded. "He is older and wiser in many ways." Catty Bree drew Wulfgar under the uncomfortable scrutiny of her dark eyes. She knew that there were other reasons for Wulfgar stepping down as king.
"You mean to go with them," she stated flatly.
"I owe it to the drow," was Wulfgar's only explanation as he turned away, in no mood to argue with the fiery girl.
"Again you parry the question," Catty Bree laughed. "You go to pay no debt. You go because you choose the road."
"What could you know of the road?" Wulfgar growled, pulled in by the girl's painfully accurate observation. "What could you know of adventure?"
Catty Bree's eyes sparkled disarmingly. "I know," she stated flatly. "Every day and every place is an adventure. This you have not yet learned. And so you chase down the distant roads, hoping to satisfy the hunger for excitement that burns in your heart. So go, Wulfgar of Icewind Dale, follow your heart's trail and be happy. Perhaps when you return, you will understand the excitement of simply being alive."
She kissed him on the cheek and skipped to the door. Wulfgar called after her, pleasantly surprised by her kiss.
"Perhaps then our discussions will be more agreeable."
"But not as interesting,"
was her parting response.
One fine morning in early spring, the time finally came for Drizden Brunner to leave. Catty Bree helped them pack their overstuffed sacks.
"When we've cleared the place, I'll take ye there,"
Brunner told the girl one more time.
"Sure your eyes'll shine when you see the rivers running silver in Mithril Hall."
Catty Bree smiled indulgently.
"You're sure you'll be all right then?"
Brunner asked more seriously. He knew that she would, but his heart flooded with fatherly concern. Catty Bree's smile widened. They had been through this discussion 100 times over the winter. Catty Bree was glad that the dwarf was going, though she knew that she would miss him dearly, for it was clear that Brunner would never truly be contented until he had at least tried to find his ancestral home. And she knew, better than anyone, that the dwarf would be in fine company. Brunner was satisfied. The time had come to go. The companions said their goodbyes to the dwarves and started off for Bryn Shander to bid farewell to their 2 closest friends. They arrived at Regis's house later in the morning and found Wulfgar sitting on the steps waiting for them, Aegis Fang and his pack by his side. Drizzt eyed the barbarians' belongings suspiciously as they approached, half-guessing Wulfgar's intentions.
"Well met, King Wulfgar," he said. "Are you off to Bremen or perhaps Caer Conic to oversee the work of your people?"
Wulfgar shook his head.
"I am no king," he replied. "Councils and speeches are better left to older men. I have had more of them than I can tolerate. Revyak speaks for the men of the tundra now."
"Then what of yourself?" asked Brunner.
"I go with you,"
Wulfgar replied, to repay my last debt.
Ye owe me nothing, Brunner declared.
To you I am paid, Wulfgar agreed, and I have paid all that I owe to Ten Towns and to my own people as well. But there is one debt I am not yet free of.
He turned to face Drizzt squarely.
To you, friend elf.
Drizzt didn't know how to reply. He clapped the huge man on the shoulder and smiled warmly.
Come with us, Rumblebelly,
Brunner said after they had finished an excellent lunch in the palace.
Four adventurers, out on the open plain. It'll do you some good, and take a bit of that belly of yours away.
Regis grasped his ample stomach in both hands and jiggled it.
I like my belly and intend to keep it, thank you. I may even add some more to it. I cannot begin to understand why you all insist on going on this quest anyway, he said more seriously.
He had spent many hours during the winter trying to talk Brunner and Drizzt out of their chosen path.
We have an easy life here. Why would you want to leave?
There is more to living than fine food and soft pillows, little friend, said Wulfgar. The lust of adventure burns our blood. With peace in the region, Ten Towns cannot offer the thrill of danger or the satisfaction of victory.
Drizzt and Brunner nodded their assent, though Regis shook his head.
And ye call this pitiful place wealth?
Brunner chuckled, snapping his stubby fingers.
When I return from Mithril Hall, I'll build ye a home twice this size and edged in gems like ye never seen afore.
But Regis was determined that he had witnessed his last adventure. After the meal was finished, he accompanied his friends to the door.
If you make it back.
Your house shall be our first stop, Drizzt assured him. They met Kemp of Targos when they walked outside. He was standing across the road from Regis's front step, apparently looking for them.
He is waiting for me,
Wulfgar explained, smiling at the notion that Kemp would go out of his way to be rid of him.
Farewell, good spokesman, Wulfgar called, bowing low. Prene de Krabug, Omkeki Rindir, be yoked iglo keskron.
Kemp flashed an obscene gesture at the barbarian and stalked away. Regis nearly doubled over with laughter. Drizzt recognized the words, but was puzzled as to why Wulfgar had spoken them to Kemp.
You once told me that those words were an old tundra battle cry, he remarked to the barbarian. Why would you offer them to the man you most despise?
Wulfgar stammered over an explanation that would get him out of this jam, but Regis answered for him.
Battle cry, the halfling exclaimed. That is an old barbarian house mother's curse, usually reserved for adulterous old barbarian house fathers.
The drow's lavender eyes narrowed on the barbarian as Regis continued.
It means, may the fleas of a thousand reindeer nest in your genitals.
Brunner broke down into laughter, Wulfgar soon joining him. Drizzt couldn't help but go along.
Come, the day is long, the drow said. Let us begin this adventure. It should prove interesting.
Where will you go?
Regis asked somberly. A small part of the halfling actually envied his friends. He had to admit that he would miss them.
To Bremen first, replied Drizzt. We shall complete our provisions there and strike out to the southwest.
Luskin?
Perhaps, if the fates deem it.
Good speed,
Regis offered, as the three companions started out without further delay. Regis watched them disappear, wondering how he had ever picked such foolish friends. He shrugged it away and turned back to his palace. There was plenty of food left over from lunch. He was stopped before he got through the door.
First citizen, came a call from the street.
The voice belonged to a warehouseman from the southern section of the city, where the merchant caravans loaded and unloaded. Regis waited for his approach.
A man, first citizen,
the warehouseman said, bowing apologetically for disturbing so important a person.
Asking about you. He claims to be a representative from the Hero Society in Luskin, sent to request your presence at their next meeting. He said that he would pay you well.
His name?
He gave none, just this.
The warehouseman opened a small pouch of gold. It was all that Regis needed to see. He left at once for the rendezvous with the man from Luskin. Once again, sheer luck saved the halfling's life, for he saw the stranger before the stranger saw him. He recognized the man at once, though he hadn't seen him in years, by the emerald-encrusted dagger hilt protruding from the sheath on his hip. Regis had often contemplated stealing that beautiful weapon, but even he had a limit to his foolhardiness. The dagger belonged to Artemis and Treri, Pasha Pook's prime assassin. The three companions left Bremen before dawn the next day. Anxious to begin the adventure, they made good time and were far out into the tundra when the first rays of the sun peeked over the eastern horizon behind them. Still, Brunner was not surprised when he noticed Regis scrambling across the empty plain to catch up with them.
"Got himself into trouble again, or I'm a bearded gnome," the dwarf snickered to Wulfgar and Drizzt.
"Well met," said Drizzt. "But haven't we already said our farewells?"
"I decided that I could not let Brunner run off into trouble without me being there to pull him out," Regis puffed, trying to catch his breath.
"You're coming?" groaned Brunner. "You've brought no supplies, fool halfling."
"I don't eat much," Regis
pleaded, an edge of desperation creeping into his voice.
"Bah! Ye eat more than the three of us together. But no mind, we'll let ye tag along anyway."
The halfling's face brightened visibly, and Drizzt suspected that the dwarf's guess about trouble wasn't far off the mark.
"The four of us, then," proclaimed Wulfgar. "One to represent each of the four common races. Brunner for the dwarves, Regis for the halflings, Drizzt O'Erden for the elves, and myself for the humans. A fitting troop."
"I hardly think the elves would choose a drow to represent them," Drizzt remarked. Brunner snorted.
"Ye think the halflings would choose Rumblebelly for their champion?"
"You're crazy, dwarf,"
retorted Regis. Brunner dropped his shield to the ground, leaped around Wulfgar, and squared off before Regis. His face contorted in mock rage as he grasped Regis by the shoulders and hoisted him into the air.
"That's right, Rumblebelly," Brunner cried wildly. "Crazy I am, and never cross one what's crazier than yourself."
Drizzt and Wulfgar looked at each other with knowing smiles. It was indeed going to be an interesting adventure. And with the rising sun at their back, their shadows standing long before them, they started off on their way to find Mithril Hall. This has been an Audible Frontiers production of The Crystal Shard, written by R.A. Salvatore, narrated by Victor Bevine. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 1988 by TSR Inc. Copyright 2005 by Wizards of the Coast Inc. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.